You are listening to Chesterton Radio at chestertonradio.com.
J-E-L-L-O.
The Jell-O program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Dennis Day, and yours truly, Don Wilson. The orchestra opens the program with Old Johnny. This morning I was looking over the book reviews of the Sunday paper and reading the lists of bestsellers. And that just happened to give me an idea. I'd like to recommend to you a grand bestseller in the field of desserts. A dessert that's not only currently popular, but has been on the bestseller list for years and years. The author is General Foods, and the name is Jell-O. And ladies and gentlemen, that's a mighty important thing, because it's a trademark. It's the property of General Foods. And it tells you here is the real thing, the one and only Jell-O. If you hear any other gelatin dessert called Jell-O, you'll know that's incorrect, for there is no other. So when you buy, don't accept any substitutes. Ask for Jell-O by name, and you can be sure every time of getting your favorite dessert. You can be sure of enjoying that delicious, extra-rich flavor, so full-bodied and tempting, as inviting as a fresh, ripe fruit. Look for those big red letters on the box. They spell Jell-O, your password to pleasure. That was Old Johnny, played by Phil Harris and his orchestra. And now, ladies and gentlemen... Oh, Jack.
Yes, Don.
Is your tooth still bothering you?
Just a little, Don, but it'll be all right. Go ahead.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, you ought to see a dentist, Jack. A toothache can be very annoying.
I know, Don, but I'm all right. Go ahead and introduce me.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, but Jack, it must hurt. Don't you feel any jumping pains?
Only when you mention it. Now, please, go ahead and introduce me.
All right, Jack. Goodness. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we bring you a man who, despite a severe toothache, feels that the show must go on. That brave little soldier, that grand old trooper, Jack Benny.
Thank you. Ooh, that tooth. Hello again, this is Jack Benny talking through a murderous molar. Well, Don, here it is Sunday again, and we're back on the old merry-go-round. Time sure flies, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You know, Jack, it doesn't seem possible that we've been on the air 6 times already this season.
No, it doesn't.
No kidding, fellas. Have we been on the air 6 weeks?
Yes, Phil, and they sure roll around fast, don't they?
Yeah, it seems like I hardly get one paycheck till I have to start battling for the next one.
Oh, you do? Well, listen, Phil, if I were you, I'd take my paychecks any way I could get them.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I wouldn't complain about your job. You're very lucky. You know, in musical circles, they refer to you as Horseshoe Harris. And that goes for your boys, too, those 17 rabbit's feet. So let well enough alone. Now, what was I talking about, Don?
You were complaining about your tooth.
I was not. I was talking about how the weeks fly by. You know, Don, sometimes it amazes me how I can prepare all the ideas that go into this program in 7 days. It's really quite a grind.
I can appreciate that, Jack. It must be pretty tough.
Oh, it is, Don. Tis.
I don't know what you're squawking about. Look at all the band numbers I gotta rehearse and get ready. It's no cinch, believe me.
Phil, you mean to tell me you actually prepare your numbers ahead of time? Those voodoo waltzes?
Sure, we gotta have everything right up to snuff. We gotta live up to our slogan, you know.
Your slogan? Oh, you've got a slogan now.
Sure, listen to this. If it's a Harris selection, it's sheer perfection.
Well, say, that's very good.
I got another one we use on the road. Get this. If it's a Harris number, you'll never slumber.
I agree with you there. And Phil, if you can stand one more slogan, it goes like this. If it's a Harris melody, it's sure to smellity. And I don't mean Christmas night. Now, where was I? What were we talking about, Don?
You were complaining about your tooth.
I was not. You know, Don, there are times... Oh, hello, Mary.
Hello, Jack. Say, what's the matter with your face?
My face?
Yeah, one cheek isn't sunk in anymore.
Oh, that's my tooth. My left cheek is swollen a little.
A little? You look like a squirrel that's all set for a long winter.
I do.
My goodness, Jack, that tooth's been bothering you all week. Why don't you have it pulled out?
Oh, the pain'll go away. Say, fellas.
I never saw anybody so scared of a dentist.
I'm not scared of a dentist. That tooth is loose and it'll probably fall out by itself.
You mean like that thin stuff on top of your head?
I mean, don't worry about me. I'll get this tooth fixed my own way.
Say, Jackson.
What?
One of my piano players don't like you. He'll be glad to knock it out.
Oh, you mean that little squirt sitting over there? Why, I'll...
No, the other one.
Oh. Oh, hello, Butch. I didn't see you. Now, go sit down.
He won't hit you, Jack, with those glasses on.
He's right, Jack. It's against the law to hit anybody that's wearing glasses.
Listen, Don, I said that to a big guy one day, and he took my glasses off, punched me in the nose, and put them back on again. So don't tell me.
What were you doing in the meantime?
Jack was explaining the law to him.
Yes, he'll know better next time. Say, Phil, how about playing a number? My tooth is acting up again. I want to put a couple of drops in it.
Okay.
What kind of toothache drops are you using, Jack?
I don't know. It's something Rochester makes. I think it's chloroform and white mule. It does the trick, though. Go ahead, Phil. Play something.
All right, Jackson. Get ready, boys. And remember, folks, if it's a Harris selection, it's sheer perfection.
Yeah.
Hey, what's that for?
Oh, you weren't here, Mary, but Phil has suddenly become slogan conscious. Give her that other one, Phil.
Well, here's one you haven't even heard yet. When Smiling Harris plays a tune, every month in the year is June. How's that, Mary?
Wow, that's corn that isn't even ripe yet.
That's a good one.
Say, Jack.
What?
If Vaudeville ever comes back, I got a swell slogan for you.
Never mind.
What is it, Mary?
When Benny plays on his violin, you can shoot him down and it ain't no sin.
Mary, we weren't talking about my violin, so that laugh doesn't count. Now, let's forget our poetry contest and get along with the show. Play something, Phil.
Now, wait a minute, Jack. You've all had your little poetry. How about giving me a chance?
Okay, Don, let's hear your contribution, said he with a look of innocence in his baby blue eyes. Take it, Don.
All right, but I want you to help me, Jack. Now, you start me off with, hello, Joe.
Okay. Hello, Joe. What do you know?
I just got back from the grocery store. Yes.
Did you buy a box of you-know-what?
Yes, sirree. That's what I got.
What's in this box that's so delish?
I bet you wish you had a dish.
Can this be Jell-O that you mean?
Yuck, yuck, yuck. I'm Madam Queen.
Mary, you spoiled the whole thing. That last line didn't make sense.
All right. Send me to Siberia.
Nothing to get funny about. Hey, genius.
What?
Play something. And that guy answers to anything if you just put a hay in front of him. Played by Phil Harris, who can now tear up his slogan. A Harris selection is sheer perfection. Oh, Maharaja.
And now, folks...
Wait a minute, Jack. Are you insinuating that number was inharmonious?
What's that?
Inharmonious. Mediocre. Lacking in finesse and euphony.
Why, Phil...
Well, that's today's work. Good night, all.
Rosalind, come back here. What a guy. He learns four big words and he's all in. And now, folks, before we... Say, where's Dennis?
I saw him downstairs with his mother just before the broadcast.
I did, too. And old Jack, is Mrs. Day mad at you?
Mad at me? Why, we got to be very good friends at my Halloween party.
Well, she was home last Sunday listening to our program, and she heard you call her a pest.
I didn't call her a pest. I said she needed a rest.
Well, she got it, so watch out.
Oh, Mary, Mrs. Day is much too broad-minded to be upset about a little joke. And now, folks... However, Mary, I wouldn't mention anything about it when she comes in. You know.
Yeah, I know.
You know how it is.
Yeah, I know how it is.
Yeah. And now, folks...
And now, folks...
Mary, let me alone. And now, folks, following our success last week with our version of The Women, tonight we are going to...
Oh, boy, wasn't I marvelous in that play.
What?
Didn't I give a terrific performance?
Yes, Phil, you were sensational. Would you consider a $1,000 raise in salary? I feel guilty having you at these prices.
That's a deal, Shake.
Get away or I'll break your arm. Terrific performance. Anyway, folks, as I was saying, following our success last week with The Women, tonight we are going to offer...
Uh-oh, look who's coming.
Well, hello, Dennis.
Hello, Mr. Benny.
And your mother's with you. Well, well, this is nice. Good evening, Mrs. Day.
How do you do?
Well, you're looking very good, Lucretia.
Thanks, and you will please refer to me as Mrs. Day.
Well.
It is now 20 degrees cooler inside.
Mary. Well, Dennis, I'm glad you're here, and I know you have a lovely song prepared for us tonight. Are you ready?
Yes, I am. Say, Mr. Benny, what's the matter with your jaw? Did someone hit you?
No, Dennis, I have a bad toothache. You know, Mrs. Day, it hurts like the dickens. It's really a miracle that I can be funny tonight.
You were very funny last week. Very funny.
Oh, did you enjoy the show?
Yes, especially the part where you called me a pest. It was such a brilliant remark.
Why, Mrs. Day, I called you a pest?
Yes, you did.
On the radio?
Yes, on the radio.
On my program?
It wasn't Duke Ginsburg and his happy Hawaiians.
Mary, quiet. Now, look, Mrs. Day, it may have sounded like I called you a pest, but this darn tooth of mine slurs my words and bother me all week.
Your tooth, huh?
Yes, you can see for yourself. Look, it's the big one right here. The one on the urn, sir?
Oh, that does look pretty bad.
Yeah, it hurts like the dickens.
Hey, Jack, let me hear you say your name.
What?
Let me hear you say your name.
Jack Rennie.
That's what I thought.
Mary, I've got a toothache. I prefer a little sympathy to ridicule.
Well, then, for heaven's sake, stop complaining and go to a dentist.
I'm not going to a dentist.
What's the matter? You afraid?
No, I'm not afraid.
Well, there's only one other reason, so let's take up a collection.
Phil, that won't be necessary. It's the first time I ever had trouble with a tooth. I haven't been to a dentist since I was 10 years old.
Don't tell me you made those uppers yourself.
No, I didn't make those uppers myself.
Well, Jack, I don't want to be an alarmist, but I think you ought to do something about that tooth. It might lead to serious consequences.
Well, gee, it does hurt, but I don't know who to go to.
I know a good dentist, Jack, and he's just 2 blocks from here. Come on, let's go.
Oh, don't pull me.
Go ahead, Jack. We'll take care of the program.
Sure, I got some swell jokes, and I'm dying to tell them.
Oh, I know your jokes, Phil. Oh, waiter, have you got frog's legs? No, I always walk this way. That's nice, smart material. Come on, Mary, let's go.
Okay.
Well, so long, fellas.
So long, Jack. All right, Dennis, you can go ahead with your song now. What's it going to be?
He's going to sing a very popular number called A Man in His Dream.
From that Paramount
picture, The Star Baker.
Starring Bing Crosby. I got that in.
Dennis, don't be such a ham. Now sing.
Always stir my imagination.
Sometimes it borders on fantasy, and sometimes I find visions flash through my mind, close to reality. Night, a soft guitar, a hidden lane, a moon, and here and there a star. For a man and his dream. Night, a cricket's cry, a whispered word, a kiss, and now and then a sigh. For a man and his dream. And their eyes, when they meet, seem to say it's sublime. And their hearts proudly beat to a tune that is older than time. Night must fade away, and yet it leaves a love, so all the world will say, there's a man and his dream. And their eyes, when they meet, seem to say it's sublime, and their hearts proudly beat to a tune that is older than time. Night must fade away, and yet it leaves a love, so all the world will say, there's a man.
Mary, my tooth doesn't seem to be bothering me now. I think I'll let it go till some other time.
You'll do nothing of the kind. Here's the dentist's office.
Well, I'd rather wait until...
He's a swell dentist, Jack. Look at that sign.
Where?
Right there. Dr. Frank Nelson. Bridges like San Francisco.
He's not very modest, is he? Well, let's go in. Hey, he's got a nice office, hasn't he?
Yeah. How do you do, sir?
How do you do? I'd like to see Dr. Nelson.
The doctor is busy with a patient right now. Would you care to wait?
Why, yes.
Well, you know what you're doing, I guess.
What?
I'll tell the doctor you're here. Please be seated.
What's that, miss? Is that a drill?
Yes, the doctor is working on a patient. Some fun, hey, kid?
Say, Mary, are you sure this dentist is all right?
Of course he's all right. Do I look worried?
No, but then I'm the one with the toothache. I'm not worried, Mary, but I just want to make sure that... Well, let's scram. I hate this waiting. Come on, Mary.
Jack, come here. Dr. Nelson is absolutely painless.
Painless? What was that, 6 o'clock? I'm getting out of here.
That'll be all for today, Mrs. Stewart. When will I see you again?
You should live so long.
Well, young man, are you waiting to see me?
Yes, but I...
Your name, please.
Benny. I'm Jack Benny, the actor.
Sorry, we don't give theatrical rates.
Well, I didn't mean it that way. I expect to pay the same price as anybody else.
Eventually.
Mary. Ooh, that tooth throbbing again.
Step right this way, please. Follow me.
Can I come in, too?
Yes, Mary, you stick right with me.
Oh, nurse, sterilize my mandibular injector and have the gutta percha ready.
Yes, doctor.
Now step into this chair, Mr. Benny, and I'll strap you in.
Strap me in?
Yes, we don't want you squirming around.
Oh.
Would you like a manicure, Mr. Benny?
No, thanks. I just dropped in to have my tooth picked.
Oh, yes, the tooth. Now, first we must determine which one it is. Yes. Just a moment. Is it this one?
No.
This one?
No.
Is it this one?
Yes! That's the one, Doctor. Heard something awful.
We'll take care of that. This is a large cavity, and I'll have to fill it right away. Do you want gold or silver?
I want cement.
Cement is no good, Mr. Benny. It wears out.
Listen, Doctor, I've seen sidewalks around here for years, and they're holding up all right. Now go ahead and fill it.
Very well, I'll use cement, and then we'll all put our footprints in it.
I'm not Grauman's Chinese. Furthermore, I don't want to bother filling this tooth. I want to pull.
All right, then perhaps I ought to give you an anesthetic.
Perhaps nothing knocked me out. Perhaps yet.
Very well, we'll give you gas. Now, take it easy, Mr. Benny. Relax and breathe deeply.
What are you going to do?
Nurse, place the mask over his nose.
Yes, Doctor.
Now, inhale slowly, and you'll soon be in dreamland.
Now, wait a minute, Doctor. Wait a minute.
Now, just relax. Bye-bye, Mr. Benny.
Mary. Mary, where are you?
Here I am, Jack.
Mary, keep your eye on my money while I'm under the... while I'm under the anesthetic.
Okay. Which sock is it in?
The right one. Hey, Doctor, I don't think I want to...
Nurse, hand me those clamps.
So you are, Doctor.
I don't think
and that saliva ejector.
Yes, Doctor.
I don't think I... I don't think I...
Well, as I live and brush my teeth with my pen, if it isn't Benny, and he's sleeping sounder than his audience on Sunday night. Mm. Oh, nurse, nurse.
Yes, Dr. Allen?
Hand me that chisel. I'm going to do this the hard way.
Here you are, Dr. Allen.
Thank you, Mrs. Day.
Mrs. Day? Fred Allen? Where am I?
The Jell-O program, starring Phil Harris with Mary Livingston, Mahatma Gandhi, George Bernard Shaw, and yours truly, Lady Godiva.
Hello again. This is Jack Benny talking.
Now hold on there, Benny. It's town hall tonight.
What?
Why, Portland, what are you laughing at?
Wait a minute, that's not Portland. That's Mary Livingston.
Shut up, Carmichael.
Carmichael? Who's Carmichael? Oh, my goodness, look at this white fur all over me.
The Jell-O program, starring Phil Harris and his orchestra. The orchestra opens a program with Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov.
That's a lie! They'll never make it. Let me out of this chair.
Now, here, hold still, Carmichael.
I'm not Carmichael. I'm Jack Benny.
Mrs. Day, hand me that crowbar. I'm not getting anywhere with this chisel.
Crowbar? Let me out of here. Let me out of here. Good thing I got away from there. Where am I? What am I doing in this cave? Who's that coming toward me?
Carmichael, your day has come.
What?
I've been waiting a long time for this.
Rochester. Rochester, what are you doing with that razor?
Ain't no use backing away, Carmichael. Winter's coming and Papa needs a fur coat.
Look, Rochester, I'm not Carmichael. This is me, your boss, Mr. Benny.
Mr. Benny?
Yes, put down that razor. I'll give you a new tuxedo. I'll give you anything you want. I'll give you a raise in salary.
You ain't Mr. Benny.
Rochester.
Carmichael, you're about to become a fond memory.
Rochester, let go of me.
Ain't no use scratching. Pull in those long claws.
These aren't claws, Rochester. These are my fingernails.
Would you like a manicure, Mr. Benny?
No, I'm just here to get my tooth pulled. Rochester, get away from me. What are you going to do?
Carmichael, I'm going to carve you up and have you for a Thanksgiving dinner.
Rochester, you don't even know when Thanksgiving is.
Who does?
Now, Rochester, for the last time, get away from me. Hiya, Rochester. Look, there's Phil Harris. He'll tell you who I am. Hello, Philzy.
Hiya, Carmichael. Here's a fish for you.
Ouch! Look at me. I'm not Carmichael. I'm Jack, your pal. Jack Benny, the actor.
I'm sorry. We don't give theatrical rates.
Doctor. Doctor.
Hand me that hacksaw, Mrs. Day. We're coming along fine.
Here you are, Doctor.
Thank you, Mrs. Day.
I'm not Mrs. Day. I'm Carmichael.
You are not. I'm Carmichael. I mean, I'm Jack Benny. Mary, what are you laughing at?
How can I laugh? I'm a poached egg.
Mary, what are you talking about? Where are you? Ooh, my tooth.
Oh, Dr. Allen, you'll never get the tooth out that way. You'll have to use dynamite.
Oh, dynamite is so messy, Mrs. Day. Hand me my machine gun.
Machine gun? No, no.
Now hold still, Benny. I want to make a nice, clean job of this.
Please, Fred, please. You can't do this to me. I'm a polar bear. Don't you love animals? Don't, Fred. Don't! Where am I? Where am I?
It's all over, Mr. Benny. That didn't hurt now, did it?
Hurt? Where's Fred Allen? Where's Harris? Wait till I get my hands on that rocket.
Now, calm down, Mr. Benny. You were just dreaming.
Dreaming? Oh, yes, you gave me gas, didn't you?
I certainly did. And here's your tooth. It's a beauty, isn't it?
My tooth?
Yes. Do you mind if I keep it? I'm an elf, you know.
Oh, that's perfectly all right. Well, I feel much better now. How much do I owe you, Doctor?
That'll be $35.
$35? Ooh!
There he goes again, folks. Play, Phil.
Repeated by a popular request. In the language of radio and the theater, that means a hit. And it means a hit, too, when applied to some tasty dish that must be served again and again because of the whole family's enthusiasm for it. Such a dish, ladies and gentlemen, is Pineapple Strawberry Whip, an exciting new Jell-O dessert. For one thing, it's as easy as can be to make. Simply dissolve one package of fragrant strawberry Jell-O in a pint of hot water. Then chill until cold and syrupy. Next, place it in a bowl of cracked ice or ice water and whip with a rotary egg beater until it becomes light and fluffy. Finally, just before molding it, fold in 1 cup of canned crushed pineapple. It's downright thrilling the way those golden tidbits of juicy pineapple complement the rich ruby goodness of strawberry Jell-O. And you can bet that everybody will want this colorful, striking dessert repeated by popular request many times. So ask your grocer tomorrow for some strawberry Jell-O. And tomorrow night, when the family gather around the dinner table, surprise them with a glorious bowl of Jell-O's new Pineapple Strawberry Whip.
The last number of the 6th program of the new Jell-O series. And we will be with you again next Sunday night at the same time. Before we say goodnight, I would like to remind you of the annual Red Cross Roll Call. Every citizen should join, because your memberships are the sole support of the regular Red Cross program of fighting the suffering caused by disease, accident, and disaster. So may I urge you to join the Red Cross through your local Red Cross chapter. Good night, folks.
J-E-L-L-O. Here's news. Every Tuesday night, the Aldrich family is on the air, starring Ezra Stone as Henry Aldrich, that lovable hard luck kid. Consult your local newspaper or radio guide from time and stations, and be sure to tune in on the Aldrich family next Tuesday night.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The History of Hudge and Gudge. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. What's Wrong with the World by G.K. Chesterton. Part 1. The Homelessness of Man. Chapter 9. History of Hudge and Gudge. There is, let us say, a certain filthy rookery in Hoxton, dripping with disease and honeycombed with crime and promiscuity. There are, let us say, 2 noble and courageous young men, of pure intentions, and, if you prefer it, noble birth. Let us call them Hudge and Gudge. Hudge, let us say, is of a bustling sort. He points out that the people must at all costs be got out of this den. He subscribes and collects money, but he finds, despite the large financial interests of the Hudges, that the thing will have to be done on the cheap if it is to be done on the spot. He therefore runs up a row of tall, bare tenements like beehives and soon has all the poor people bundled into their little brick cells, which are certainly better than their old quarters, in so far that they are weatherproof, well ventilated, and supplied with clean water. But Gudge has a more delicate nature. He feels a nameless something lacking in the little brick boxes. He raises numberless objections. He even assails the celebrated Hudge Report with the Gudge Minority Report, and by the end of a year or so has come to telling Hudge heatedly that the people were much happier where they were before. As the people persevere in both places precisely the same air of dazed amiability, it is very difficult to find out which is right. But at least one might safely say that no people ever liked stench or starvation as such, but only some peculiar pleasures entangled with them. Not so feels the sensitive Gudge. Long before the final quarrel, Hudge v. Gudge and another, Gudge has succeeded in persuading himself that slums and stinks are really very nice things, that the habit of sleeping 14 in a room is what has made our England great, and that the smell of open drains is absolutely essential to the rearing of a Viking breed. But, meanwhile, has there been no degeneration in Hudge? Alas, I fear there has. Those maniacally ugly buildings which he originally put up as unpretentious sheds, barely to shelter human life, grow every day more and more lovely in his deluded eye. Things he would never have dreamed of defending, except as crude necessities, things like common kitchens or infamous asbestos stoves, begin to shine quite sacredly before him, merely because they reflect the wrath of Gudge. He maintains, with the aid of eager little books by socialists, that man is really happier in a hive than in a house. The practical difficulty of keeping total strangers out of your bedroom he describes as brotherhood, and the necessity for climbing 23 flights of cold stone stairs, I dare say he calls effort. The net result of their philanthropic adventure is this, that one has come to defending indefensible slums and still more indefensible slum landlords, while the other has come to treating as divine the sheds and pipes, which he only meant as desperate. Gudge is now a corrupt and apoplectic old Tory in the Carlton Club. If you mention poverty to him, he roars at you in a thick, hoarse voice, something that is conjectured to be, "Do him good." Nor is Hudge more happy, for he is a lean vegetarian with a gray, pointed beard and an unnaturally easy smile, who goes about telling everybody that at last we shall all sleep in one universal bedroom, and he lives in a garden city, like one forgotten of God. Such is the lamentable history of Hudge and Gudge, which I merely introduce as a type of an endless and exasperating misunderstanding which is always occurring in modern England. To get men out of the rookery, men are put into a tenement, and at the beginning the healthy human soul loathes them both. A man's first desire is to get away as far as possible from the rookery, even should his mad course lead him to a model dwelling. The second desire is, naturally, to get away from the model dwelling, even if it should lead a man back to the rookery. But I am neither a Hudgian nor a Gudgian, and I think the mistakes of these two famous and fascinating persons arose from one simple fact. They arose from the fact that neither Hudge nor Gudge had ever thought for an instant what sort of a house a man might probably like for himself. In short, they did not begin with the ideal, and therefore were not practical politicians. We may now return to the purpose of our awkward parenthesis about the praise of the future and the failures of the past. A house of his own being the obvious ideal for every man, we may now ask, taking this need as typical of all such needs, why he hasn't got it, and whether it is, in any philosophical sense, his own fault. Now, I think that in some philosophical sense it is his own fault. I think in a yet more philosophical sense it is the fault of his philosophy. And this is what I have now to attempt to explain. Burke, a fine rhetorician who rarely faced realities, said, "I think that an Englishman's house is his castle." This is honestly entertaining, for as it happens, the Englishman is almost the only man in Europe whose house is not his castle. Nearly everywhere else exists the assumption of peasant proprietorship, that a poor man may be a landlord, though he is only lord of his own land. Making the landlord and the tenant the same person has certain trivial advantages, as that the tenant pays no rent while the landlord does a little work, and I am not concerned with the defense of small proprietorship, but merely with the fact that it exists almost everywhere except in England. It is also true, however, that this estate of small possession is attacked everywhere today. It has never existed among ourselves, and it may be destroyed among our neighbors. We have, therefore, to ask ourselves what it is in human affairs generally, and in this domestic ideal in particular, that has really ruined the natural human creation, especially in this country. Man has always lost his way. He has been a tramp ever since Eden, but he always knew, or thought he knew, what he was looking for. Every man has a house somewhere in the elaborate cosmos. His house waits for him, waist-deep in slow Norfolk rivers, or sunning itself upon Sussex Downs. Man has always been looking for that home which is the subject matter of this book, but in the bleak and blinding hail of skepticism to which he has been now so long subjected, he has begun for the first time to be chilled, not merely in his hopes, but in his desires. For the first time in history, he begins really to doubt the object of his wanderings on the earth. He has always lost his way, but now he has lost his address. Under the pressure of certain upper-class philosophies, or in other words, under the pressure of Hudge and Gudge, the average man has really become bewildered about the goal of his efforts, and his efforts, therefore, grow feebler and feebler. His simple notion of having a house of his own is derided as bourgeois, as sentimental, or as despicably Christian. Under various verbal forms he is recommended to go on to the streets, which is called individualism, or to the workhouse, which is called collectivism. We shall consider this process somewhat more carefully in a moment, but it may be said here that Hudge and Gudge, or the governing class generally, will never fail for lack of some modern phrase to cover their ancient predominance. The great lords will refuse the English peasant his 3 acres and a cow on advanced grounds, if they cannot refuse it longer on reactionary grounds. They will deny him the 3 acres on grounds of state ownership. They will forbid him the cow on grounds of humanitarianism. And this brings us to the ultimate analysis of this singular influence that has prevented doctrinal demands by the English people. There are, I believe, some who will still deny that England is governed by an oligarchy. It is quite enough for me to know that a man might have gone to sleep some 30 years ago over the day's newspaper and woke up last week over the latter newspaper and fancied he was reading about the same people. In one paper he would have found a Lord Robert Cecil, a Mr. Gladstone, a Mr. Littleton, a Churchill, a Chamberlain, a Trevelyan, an Acland. In the other paper he would have found a Lord Robert Cecil, a Mr. Gladstone, a Mr. Littleton, a Churchill, a Chamberlain, a Trevelyan, an Acland. If this is not being governed by families, I cannot imagine what it is. I suppose it is being governed by extraordinary democratic coincidences. End of The History of Hudge and Gudge. recorded by Craig Campbell in Appleton, Wisconsin in 2009.
This is ChestertonRadio.com.
Oppression by Optimism. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Barry Holdsworth. What's Wrong with the World by G.K. Chesterton, Part 1, Chapter 10. Oppression by Optimism. But we are not here concerned with the nature and existence of the aristocracy, but with the origin of its peculiar power. Why is it the last of the true oligarchies of Europe, and why does there seem no very imminent prospect of our seeing the end of it? The explanation is simple, though it remains strangely unnoticed. The friends of the aristocracy often praise it for preserving ancient and gracious traditions. The enemies of aristocracy often blame it for clinging to cruel or antiquated customs. Both its enemies and its friends are wrong. Generally speaking, the aristocracy does not preserve either good or bad traditions. It does not preserve anything except game. Who would dream of looking among aristocrats anywhere for an old custom? One might as well look for an old costume. The god of the aristocrats is not tradition, but fashion, which is the opposite of tradition. If you wanted to find an old-world Norwegian headdress, would you look for it in the Scandinavian smart set? No. The aristocrats never have customs. At the best, they have habits, like the animals. Only the mob has customs. The real power of the English aristocrats has lain in exactly the opposite of tradition. The simple key to the power of our upper classes is this, that they have always kept carefully on the side of what is called progress. They have always been up to date, and this comes quite easy to an aristocracy. For the aristocracy are the supreme instances of that frame of mind of which we spoke just now. Novelty is to them a luxury verging on a necessity. They, above all, are so bored with the past and with the present that they gape with a horrible hunger for the future. But whatever else the great lords forgot, they never forgot that it was their business to stand for the new things, for whatever was being most talked about among university dons or fussy financiers. Thus they were on the side of the Reformation against the Church, of the Whigs against the Stuarts, of the Baconian science against the old philosophy, of the manufacturing system against the operatives, and, today, of the increased power of the state against the old-fashioned individualists. In short, the rich are always modern. It is their business. But the immediate effect of this fact upon the question we are studying is somewhat singular. In each of the separate holes or quandaries in which the ordinary Englishman has been placed, he has been told that his situation is, for some particular reason, all for the best. He woke up one fine morning and discovered that the public things, which for 800 years he had used at once as inns and sanctuaries, had all been suddenly and savagely abolished, to increase the private wealth of about 6 or 7 men. One would think he might have been annoyed at this. In many places he was, and was put down by the soldiery. But it was not merely the army that kept him quiet. He was kept quiet by the sages as well as the soldiers. The 6 or 7 men who took away the inns of the poor told him that they were not doing it for themselves, but for the religion of the future, the great dawn of Protestantism and truth. So whenever a 17th-century noble was caught pulling down a peasant's fence and stealing his field, the noble pointed excitedly at the face of Charles I or James II, which at that moment perhaps wore a cross expression, and thus diverted the simple peasant's attention. The great Puritan lords created the Commonwealth and destroyed the common land. They saved their poorer countrymen from the disgrace of paying ship money by taking from them the plough money and spade money, which they were doubtless too weak to guard. A fine old English rhyme has immortalized this aristocratic habit. You prosecute the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but leave the larger felon loose who steals the common from the goose. But here, as in the case of the monasteries, we confront the strange problem of submission. If they stole the common from the goose, one can only say that he was a great goose to stand it. The truth is, they reasoned with the goose. They explained to him that all this was needed to get the Stuart fox overseas. So in the 19th century, the great nobles who became mine owners and railway directors earnestly assured everybody that they did not do this from preference, but owing to a newly discovered economic law. So the prosperous politicians of our own generation introduced bills to prevent poor mothers from going about with their own babies, or they calmly forbid their tenants to drink beer in public inns. But this insolence is not, as you would suppose, howled at by everybody as outrageous feudalism. It is gently rebuked as socialism, for an aristocracy is always progressive. It is a form of going the pace. Their parties grow later and later at night, for they are trying to live tomorrow. End of Oppression by Optimism.
The Jell-O program, starring Jack Benny, with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Dennis Day, and yours truly, Don Wilson. The orchestra opens the program with Silly. Here is some helpful advice for every woman who likes to keep her family in good spirits. Give them Jell-O for dessert, not just once in a while, but often. For one of the grandest things about Jell-O is the wide variety of ways in which you can serve it. There are six lovely, glowing colors to add real beauty to your menus. Six rich, delicious flavors to tempt every appetite. And there's almost no limit to the different Jell-O dishes which you can prepare. Dozens and dozens of desserts and salads, easy to make, attractive to look at, swell to taste. You'll find definite recipe suggestions on every package of Jell-O. Just be sure you get genuine Jell-O and don't accept any substitute. For there's only one Jell-O, and only Jell-O brings you that delicious, extra-rich flavor. So look for the big red letters on the box. They spell Jell-O, and Jell-O spells a treat. Played by Phil Harris and his orchestra. And now, ladies and gentlemen, this being the first Sunday in November, we bring you the last rose of summer, Jack Benny.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello again, this is Jack Benny talking. And Don, I've heard you give me some pretty silly introductions in the past, but that one takes the cake. Last rose of summer. What does that mean, anyway?
Well, it doesn't mean anything. I was just trying to be clever, that's all.
Don, you just make with the Jell-O. I'll take care of the clever stuff around here. Anyway, I don't want to start out every broadcast talking about me. Me all the time. It's embarrassing.
It's a little dull, too.
Oh, it is. Well, Phil, let me ask you something now that you've established your presence among us. Is this program getting a little too monotonous for you?
Well, it's not exactly...
I mean, do you find me personally so incompatible?
Income what?
Incompatible.
Would you mind cutting that down where I can get at it?
Not at all. What I'm trying to get at, Phil, is this. Do I bore you? I mean, do I grate on your nerves?
No, not exactly. Why?
Because, Phil, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, when orchestra leader unhappy over job, him soon clap hands with joy in bread line. Very good advice. Oh, hello, Mary.
Hello, One Lung. Is my laundry ready? Never mind that. You know, Mary, I don't know why I even argue with Phil. I use an ordinary word like incompatible, and it throws him. He's absolutely illiterate.
Well, it's your own fault, Jack. You knew he couldn't read when you hired him.
What do you mean?
You had to draw up his contract with pictures.
Oh, that's right. I remember. I had to get a lawyer and Rube Goldberg. Say, Mary, did you see Dennis Day when you came in? I told him to be here early tonight.
Yeah, I saw him downstairs in the drugstore, and I got some good news for you, Jack.
What?
I don't think his mother's with him.
How do you know?
He was on his third banana split.
Oh. I knew he'd go on a spree the minute he got away from her. Three banana splits, eh?
And a malted milk.
Three banana splits and a malted milk?
With an egg in it.
With an egg in it?
And a hamburger sandwich.
A hamburger sandwich?
With onions.
With onions?
Little Sir Echo, shut up, shut up.
I will if you will. Mary, you must be mistaken. Dennis couldn't possibly eat all that stuff and three banana splits.
With cherries.
Well, here we go again, folks. Now, look, Mary, run out and get Dennis. We have an important play to do tonight, and I want to start casting it right away.
He'll be here in a minute.
Oh, Jack, is this the play you were telling me about?
Yes, Don, and we've got to get going on it. In fact, I'm going to announce it right away. Hey, Phil, give me a chord and G, will you?
You'll take a chord any place we happen to hit it.
That I know. The chord, please. Thank you. And now, ladies and gentlemen...
Boys, that was grand.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, tonight, for our supreme effort in our current dramatic season, we are going to offer our version of one of the most famous stage and screen productions of all time. None other than that sensational play, an equally sensational motion picture, The Women. Thank you, Max. Now, this play was written by that renowned playwright, Miss Claire Booth, and was first produced in New York City by Max Gordon, who just hit the cymbal. Then Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, realizing its dramatic and comedy potentialities...
Potentialities?
Yes, Phil, I'll cut it down for you later. Brought this great vehicle to Hollywood and created an outstanding film success. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, the Benny theatrical termites will munch on it. Now, in our version...
Hey, Jack, how are we going to do The Women when I'm the only girl in our show?
We'll just have to do the best we can, Mary.
You mean we're all going to be women tonight?
Exactly. Well, not exactly, but I've got it all... But I've got it all figured out. Now, to start with, I will play the leading role as portrayed on the screen by that lovely and talented actress, Miss Norma Shearer.
Oh, no, Jackson, no, no!
Well, Mary, somebody's got to do it.
Why can't I be the leading lady?
What?
I look more like Norma Shearer than you do.
Isn't that awful? You look more like Norma Shearer than I do.
Yes, I do.
In an evening gown? Don't be ridiculous. Phil, you're going to be Rosalind Russell. Don, you're going to be Joan Crawford. And Mary...
I know, I'm going to be Wallace Beery.
Mary, will you please be serious? Since all the rest of you are going to be women tonight, you'll have to be a man. Mary, you're going to be Don Wilson and announce our play. Now, let's see, is Dennis here yet? Oh, Dennis?
Yes, please?
Oh, hello, Dennis. I didn't see you come in. You know, we're casting our play, The Women.
Am I going to be in it?
Yes, you're going to play Joan Fontaine's part. You know, the little girl that just got married.
Boy, what a day. Three banana splits and now I'm a bride.
Yes, that's quite a schedule.
Say, Jack, if you're going to play Norma Shearer's part, who's going to be your daughter?
My daughter? Oh, yes, Dennis. I'll have to change your role. Instead of the young bride, you're going to be my 5-year-old daughter, Denise.
5 years old?
Yes.
And you're going to be his mother?
Yes. What are you laughing at?
You got a late start, didn't you, Ma?
Mary, I'd be quiet if I were you, lest the new May Company get an old employee. You know, reunion at Fairfax and Wilshire. Now, let's see. Oh, yes. Where's Rochester?
Here I am, monsieur.
Rochester, I sent for you because we're short of actors, and you'll have to play the part of my maid.
Your maid?
Yes.
Why can't I be your valet?
Because I don't want a man in my room, and I'm dressing. So you're going to be my maid. Now, fellas...
I ain't going to wear no dress.
You are, too. Now, fellas...
I ain't going to put on no mascara.
You are, too. Now, fellas...
It ain't going to show.
All right. Now, fellas, remember, we must be very legitimate. The only reason we're playing the part of women is because we're short of actresses.
Well, why don't you hire a few?
You know, Phil, women are so scarce in Hollywood.
Mary, if you're inferring I'm too cheap to hire actresses, come right out and say so.
All right, you're too cheap to hire actresses.
Anyway, folks, our version of the women will go on immediately after Dennis Day's song.
Oh, Jack.
Yes, Don.
Who's going to play Mary Boland's part? You know, the Countess de Lage.
I can't tell you, Don. I'm saving that for a surprise. Andy, now you spoiled it. Go ahead and sing, Dennis. Nobody can keep a secret around here.
Last night I touched your fingertips, and when I touched your lips, I fell in love last night. Last night I felt your heart beat fast, swiftly the moment passed. Why couldn't it last night? Tonight, here I am all alone. My lovely dream has flown. Why must I be alone? I miss you. Last night, why did we say goodbye? My heart keeps asking why couldn't it last night? It was so heavenly. The sweetest kiss is one that lingers on. The dearest memory always lingers with the dawn. And in my heart, these things live on. Tonight, here I am all alone. My lovely dream has flown. Why must I be alone? I miss you. Last night, why did we say goodbye? My heart keeps asking why couldn't it last
Last night, sung by Dennis Day. And see, you did very well without your mother. You don't need her here at all. You know, Dennis, there are times when your mother's a pest.
Be careful, she's listening in.
That's what I say. Your mother needs a rest. She's entitled to it. And now, ladies and gentlemen...
See, Jack, I could have sworn you said Dennis's mother was a pest.
Well, I'm getting this front tooth fixed, Marriott. Slurs my words. And now, ladies and gentlemen, for our play, The Women, which we will present in two acts. Darn that front tooth. See what it does to me. All right, take it, Mary. You're the announcer. Wait a minute. Answer the phone, will you, Don? I'm busy.
Okay, Jack. Hello?
Hello, is this Grauman's Chinese Theater?
What's that, madam?
Is this Grauman's Chinese Theater?
Oh, yes, madam. Jell-O does come in six delicious flavors. Strawberry, raspberry, cherry, orange, lemon, and lime.
I said, is this Grauman's Chinese Theater?
Yes, indeed. You must be sure to ask for genuine Jell-O and look for the big red letters on the box.
Well, what time does the feature go on?
You're welcome, madam. Goodbye.
Are you through, Don?
Sure, go ahead.
All right, Mary, announce our play.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the women. The opening scene is a fashionable Park Avenue residence of Mrs. J. Updike Benny. As the curtain rises, we find Mrs. Benny seated in her boudoir, talking to her 16-year-old daughter, Denise.
Mary, I said Dennis is 5 years old.
I'm making him 16. He just winked at me.
Oh.
The women. Act one. Curtain. Music.
Oh, Denise.
Yes, Mumsy?
We're having dinner alone, darling. Just you and I. Daddy's working late at the office.
Oh, Mother, when are you going to wake up? When are you going to realize that men are only snakes in the grass?
Denise, I will not have you talking that way about your father.
But gee, Mumsy, Father hasn't been home to dinner in 5 years.
Well, maybe he isn't hungry. I trust Updike implicitly. Oh, dear, it's getting late. Darling, hand me my foundation cream. I must get made up.
Aren't you going to shave first?
Denise, I'm not a bearded lady. Oh, Rochelle.
Yes?
What are you doing?
I'm pressing your pants.
Rochelle! Now, Rochelle, I want you to go down to the kitchen and tell the cook Mr. Benny won't be home to dinner tonight.
That's a pretty long walk for so little news.
Never mind. Mr. Benny is detained at the office.
Don't tell me about men. I married 8 of them.
Well, Rochelle, wasn't there even one of them who was nice and sweet and kind to you? One you could trust?
Mrs. Benny is one woman to another.
Well, I refuse to be cynical.
There's the phone, Mumsy.
Yes, I'll take it, dear. Darn this negligee. I'm always tripping over it.
Don't be so clumsy, Mumsy.
I wonder who that can be. I hope it's your father, Denise.
Has he got our phone number?
Denise. Hello? Hello, Jacqueline. This is Phyllis. Oh, Phyllis, darling, how are you? When did you get back from Bermuda?
Yesterday, and my dear, I had a marvelous time.
Did you really? How was the trip back, Phyllis?
Oh, divine, and the captain was a dream. He chased me all over the boat.
Oh, Phyllis. Pardon me a minute. Rochelle, hook me up, please. I want to get dressed while I'm phoning.
Okay, Mrs. Benny, inhale.
Oh, Phyllis, do tell me more about your trip.
Well, Jacqueline, who do you think I met on the boat honeymooning with a South American cattle man? You just die.
Who was it, Phyllis? Tell me.
Donna Wilson.
Donna Wilson? Is that tub still kicking around? My goodness.
Tub, nothing. You should see her now. She's quite slim.
Now, she might look that way when she's dressed, but if her stays ever snap, watch out. Tell me, Phyllis.
Ow!
Rochelle, be careful with those hooks.
Okay, Miss Benny. Where do you want this buckle?
Where do you think I want it? Phyllis, darling, I'm just dying to see you. Let's have lunch tomorrow at the Park Villa.
Oh, grand. Shall we meet in the Rendis Booth room?
That's rendezvous room. It'll think you went to Vassar. I'll tell you what, Phyllis. I'll call Donna, and we'll have a little get-together.
All right, darling. See you tomorrow.
Bye-bye, dear.
Bye-bye. Oh, by the way, Jacqueline, I almost forgot to ask you, how is Updike?
Updike?
Here they go, folks. Meow!
Oh, Updike's just fine, darling. He's been very, very busy at the office, poor boy.
I saw him at the Silver Slipper last night. He was pretty busy there, too.
The Silver Slipper? Are you sure, Phyllis?
Why, yes. I hope I haven't shocked you, dear. I thought you knew.
Oh, I'm sure you must be mistaken. Well, my dear, see you tomorrow. The Park Villa for lunch.
Yes, goodbye, darling. You poor thing.
The hussy. I could scratch her eyes out.
What's the matter, Mother?
Nothing, darling. You run along and have your dinner. I don't feel like eating tonight.
Why?
Never mind. Now come over here and kiss Mother goodnight. Good night, darling.
Good night, Mother. Ooh, those cigars.
I've been putting up with that for years.
Phyllis, the cat, the hussy. Why did she have to tell me? Oh, Updike. Updike. How can you do this to me? You said you'd love me in December as you do as you would in May. And here it is November. I know I'm not pretty anymore, Updike. But I've given you the best years of my life.
Oh, come now, honey, don't cry.
I can't help it, Rochelle.
I told you men are no good, none of them.
But what'll I do, Rochelle? This is so humiliating. What'll I do?
Honey, take this razor, find that man, and make way for tomorrow.
Rochelle!
Clambake will go on immediately after the next number. Play, girls. And her redhead. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Act Two, the women. The scene is the rendezvous room of the Park Villa Hotel, where we find Phyllis Harris and Donna Wilson, three charming ladies, awaiting the arrival of Jacqueline Benny. The women, curtain, me, music.
Well, Donna, I just couldn't believe my eyes. Updike is sure giving her the runaround.
If you ask me, Phyllis, Jacqueline's got just about as much appeal as a parsnip.
Oh, she'd be all right if she just put her wig on straight.
No fooling. Does Jacqueline wear a wig?
Yes, half the time she looks like a French poodle. Quiet, Donna. Here she comes now.
Oh, hello, girls. Phyllis, Donna.
Jacqueline, darling.
And did you hear what happened after that?
Did we?
And to make it worse, oh, it was simply awful. Now, don't breathe a word of this to a soul.
We won't. Oh, here, Jacqueline, have a dish of Jell-O.
Thank you, darling. And, Donna, I can't get over how thin you look. Why, you're nothing but skin and bones.
And did you notice how my chins have gone down?
Yes, down to your stomach. Oh, I was just pooping, Donna.
Oh, girls, girls. Look who's sitting at that table over there.
Where? Oh, yes, and is she getting high hats since she's been on the radio?
Who is it, Jacqueline?
It's Frida Allen. Isn't she a sight?
Get a load of that dress.
You know, Frieda Allen has the worst taste. She should never wear short sleeves with that anchor tattooed on her arm. And girls, you want to hear something else? Frieda's going to the hospital tomorrow to have her face lifted.
What, again?
Yes. About every 3 months, she has a landslide. Oh, look, girls, look. Here comes Andrea Devine.
Andrea?
I thought she was in Paris. Hello, Andrea.
Hiya, Jacqueline.
Andrea, darling, what are you doing here? I thought you were living abroad.
I was, but I came back to marry a cowboy.
A cowboy? How thrilling. What's his name, Andrea?
I forget it, but it's on his guitar.
Oh. Are you very much in love, Andrea?
Am I? L'amour, toujours l'amour.
Well, by the way, Andrea, why did you divorce the Count? I'm just dying to know.
Oh, Pierre was always so busy at the office. He was working night and day.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Like guess who, eh, Jacqueline?
Now, listen, fellas. I'll have none of your innuendos. Just because Updike happens to be working at the office a great deal, you don't need to jump at conclusions. He's a very good husband.
Oh, stop trying to kid us. It's all over between you and Updike, and you know it.
Phyllis Harris, you take that back or I'll scratch your eyes out.
Girls, girls!
You do and I'll pull your hair out.
I'll pull your hair out, too.
I'll bet Jack gets more than Phil does.
Phyllis, you say one more word about Updike and I'll slap the rouge right off your face. And then will those bags show.
It's no use, Jacqueline. You can't compete with them chorus girls.
I can't, eh? Take that! Take that! And that! And that!
Oh, let go of my hair!
Watch those fingernails!
Ladies and gentlemen, while those two women are acting like women, let me remind you that Jell-O is not only economical and easy to make, but it is America's favorite gelatin dessert. So look for the big red letters on the box.
Take that! And that! And that! That'll teach you, Phyllis Harris. I'm going home. Pay the check, Donna. Goodbye.
Later that night, we find the heartbroken Mrs. Benny in her boudoir, packing for her trip to Reno. And she's not going for the scenery. Music!
I'll show up, Di. Can't treat me like that. He can't humiliate me in front of all my friends. Denise, hand me my hat box.
Oh, Mumsy, why are you packing all your bags? Where are you going?
I'm going to Reno.
Reno?
Yes.
Gee, Mother, don't you love Father anymore?
How can I love him when he won't come home? Oh, Denise, your mother's been a fool. A blind fool. For 5 years, I haven't seen your father. 5 long years.
But, Mother, dear...
No use, Denise. I can't keep it from you any longer. Your father is a louse. Now, let's hurry, dear, or we'll miss the train. Who can that be? Come in.
Mrs. Benny?
Yes, what do you want?
Don't you remember me? I'm your husband, Updike.
Updike! Oh, I knew you'd return to me. I knew it. Oh, Updike, darling.
Let go of me. I just came back in my long underwear.
Oh, they're in the bottom drawer. Play, Phil. Come along, Venus. We're going to Reno.
Housewife knows that the best compliment her guest can pay her is to come back for second helping. And that's the kind of compliment you get every time when you serve one of the new Jell-O puddings for dessert. I'm thinking right now of Jell-O butterscotch pudding, a handsome taffy-colored dessert served up in shining sherbet glasses and sprinkled with a white curly blanket of shredded coconut. Now there's a real pudding for you. It has a texture smooth as cream. And that mellow, distinctive flavor of old-fashioned butterscotch candy the whole family will love. Jell-O chocolate pudding, too, has a rich, luscious, homemade goodness that just seems to hit the spot. And don't forget Jell-O vanilla pudding, please. You'll find its delicate, creamy flavor makes a hit with the whole family, especially when it has nuts, fruits, or chopped dates mixed in to give it that final tempting touch. All three Jell-O puddings are quick as a flash to make. So get acquainted with America's newest dessert sensation, the dessert the whole country is talking about. Jell-O pudding, butterscotch, chocolate, and vanilla. Old-fashioned favorites made a new-fashioned way. ¶¶
This is the last number of the fifth program in the new Jell-O series, and we will be with you again next Sunday night at the same time. Say, Mary, as a member of the fair sex, what do you think of the way we fellas did the women tonight? I thought it was pretty good, didn't you?
Well, Jack, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, Lum Gao Ching Lung Chang Lu Toi.
What does that mean?
Oh, how I'd love to tell you.
Good night, folks.
Here's news. Every Tuesday night, the Aldrich family is on the air, starring Ezra Stowe and Henry Aldrich, that lovable hard luck kid. Consult your local newspaper or radio guide for time and station, and be sure to tune in on the Aldrich family next Tuesday night. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The Homelessness of Jones. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Barry Holdsworth. What's Wrong with the World by G.K. Chesterton, Part 1, Chapter 11. The Homelessness of Jones. Thus, the future of which we spoke at the beginning has, in England at least, always been the ally of tyranny. The ordinary Englishman has been duped out of his old possessions, such as they were, and always in the name of progress. The destroyers of the abbeys took away his bread and gave him a stone, assuring him that it was a precious stone, the white pebble of the Lord's elect. They took away his maypole and his original rural life, and promised him instead the golden age of peace and commerce, inaugurated at the Crystal Palace. And now they are taking away the little that remains of his dignity as a householder and the head of a family, promising him instead utopias, which are called, appropriately enough, anticipations, or news from nowhere. We come back, in fact, to the main feature which has already been mentioned. The past is communal, the future must be individualist. In the past are all the evils of democracy, variety and violence and doubt, but the future is pure despotism, for the future is pure caprice. Yesterday I know I was a human fool, but tomorrow I can easily be the Superman. The modern Englishman, however, is like a man who should be perpetually kept out, for one reason after another, from the house in which he had meant his married life to begin. This man, Jones, let us call him, has always desired the divinely ordinary things. He has married for love. He has chosen or built a small house that fits like a coat. He is ready to be a great-grandfather and a local god. And just as he is moving in, something goes wrong. Some tyranny, personal or political, suddenly debars him from the home, and he has to take his meals in the front garden. A passing philosopher, who is also, by mere coincidence, the man who turned him out, pauses and, leaning elegantly on the railing, explains to him that he is now living that bold life upon the bounty of nature which will be the life of the sublime future. He finds life in the front garden more bold than bountiful, and has to move into mean lodgings in the next spring. The philosopher, who turned him out, happening to call at these lodgings, with the probable intention of raising the rent, stops to explain to him that he is now in the real life of mercantile endeavour. The economic struggle between him and the landlady is the only thing out of which, in the sublime future, the wealth of nations can come. He is defeated in the economic struggle and goes to the workhouse. The philosopher, who turns him out, happening at that very moment to be inspecting the workhouse, assures him that he is now at last in that golden republic which is the goal of mankind. He is in an equal scientific socialistic commonwealth, owned by the state and ruled by public officers. In fact, the commonwealth of the sublime future. Nevertheless, there are signs that the irrational Jones still dreams at night of this old idea of having an ordinary home. He asked for so little and has been offered so much. He has been offered bribes of worlds and systems. He has been offered Eden and Utopia and the New Jerusalem. And he only wanted a house, and that has been refused him. Such an apologue is literally no exaggeration of the facts of English history. The rich did literally turn the poor out of the old guest house onto the road, briefly telling them that it was the road of progress. They did literally force them into factories and the modern wage slavery, assuring them all the time that this was the only way to wealth and civilization. Just as they had dragged the rustic from the convent food and ale by saying that the streets of heaven were paved with gold, so now they dragged him from the village food and ale by telling him that the streets of London were paved with gold. As he entered the gloomy porch of Puritanism, so he entered the gloomy porch of industrialism, being told that each of them was the gate of the future. Hitherto, he has only gone from prison to prison, nay, into darkening prisons, for Calvinism opened one small window upon heaven. And now he is asked, in the same educated and authoritative tones, to enter another dark porch, at which he has to surrender into unseen hands his children, his small possessions, and all the habits of his fathers. Whether this last opening be in truth any more inviting than the old openings of Puritanism and industrialism can be discussed later, but there can be little doubt, I think, that if some form of collectivism is imposed upon England, it will be imposed, as everything else has been, by an instructed political class upon a people partly apathetic and partly hypnotized. The aristocracy will be as ready to administer collectivism as they were to administer Puritanism or Manchesterism. In some ways, such a centralized political power is necessarily attractive to them. It will not be so hard as some innocent socialists seem to suppose to induce the Honorable Tom Noddy to take over the milk supply as well as the stamp supply, at an increased salary. Mr. Bernard Shaw has remarked that rich men are better than poor men on parish councils because they are free from financial timidity. Now the English ruling class is quite free from financial timidity. The Duke of Sussex will be quite ready to be the administrator of Sussex at the same screw. Sir William Harcourt, that typical aristocrat, put it quite correctly. We, that is, the aristocracy, are all socialists now. But this is not the essential note on which I desire to end. My main contention is that, whether necessary or not, both industrialism and collectivism have been accepted as necessities, not as naked ideals or desires. Nobody liked the Manchester School. It was endured as the only way of producing wealth. Nobody likes the Marxian school. It is endured as the only way of preventing poverty. Nobody's real heart is in the idea of preventing a free man from owning his own farm, or an old woman from cultivating her own garden, any more than anybody's real heart was in the heartless battle of the machines. The purpose of this chapter is sufficiently served in indicating that this proposal is also a piss alla, a desperate second best, like teetotalism. I do not propose to prove here that socialism is a poison. It is enough if I maintain that it is a medicine and not a wine. The idea of private property universal but private, the idea of families free but still families, of domesticity democratic, but still domestic, of one man, one house. This remains the real vision and magnet of mankind. The world may accept something more official and general less human and intimate. But the world will be like a broken-hearted woman who makes a humdrum marriage because she may not make a happy one. Socialism may be the world's deliverance, but it is not the world's desire. End of The Homelessness of Jones.
This is Chesterton Radio, your home for podcasts of works by G.K. Chesterton, plus drama, comedy, mystery, science fiction, big bands, and much more. The soundtrack to your Chesterton day at chestertonradio.com.